From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we call Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid at his home in Lahore to talk about the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. Then we'll continue our retrospective featuring some of our favorite interviews of 2007 with actors, filmmakers, and musicians. We'll hear from Mark Ruffalo, who has starred in such movies as You Can Count on Me, In the Cut, Zodiac, and Reservation Road. He'll tell us what it was like to return to acting after recovering from surgery for a benign brain tumor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As soon as we heard about the assassination of Benazir Bhutto this morning, we called Ahmed Rashid, a Pakistani journalist who has written extensively about politics in his country and about Islamic extremism in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. We've spoken with him several times about President Musharraf and the parliamentary election for which Bhutto had returned after 8 years of self-imposed exile. She hoped to become prime minister, a position she'd held twice in the past. At the rally in which she was assassinated, she spoke about the risks she faced during her campaign, saying, "I put my life in danger and came here because I feel this country is in danger. People are worried. We will bring the country out of this crisis." Less than 2 hours after she was killed, we recorded a brief conversation with Ahmed Rashid from his home in Lahore, Pakistan, where it was about 8 p.m. Ahmed Rashid, did you ever expect that this would happen? I know that you knew that Benazir Bhutto was in danger, but did you think she'd actually be assassinated?
I think nobody in Pakistan wanted to believe that such a thing could happen, even though, of course, the fear was always there. When she returned to Pakistan 3 months ago, there was a horrible bomb blast in which 140 people were killed. People even then didn't want to accept the fact that maybe that was an assassination attempt. People thought that maybe that bomb blast was there to scare her off from fighting the elections. But clearly what has happened today has been a very well-planned and thought-out assassination attempt using a combination of a sniper and one or two suicide bombers. And it has left a devastation in the country. People are grief-stricken, people are in shock, there is severe rioting taking place as I speak in Lahore and right in major cities right across the country as people burn government vehicles and attack government buildings. So there's a very, very severe reaction to her death.
What are likely to be the short and long-term consequences of the assassination?
Well, I think the short-term consequences are most likely to be the cancellation of the elections on the 8th of January, in which Benazir Bhutto was a candidate, and there could well be the declaration of some kind of martial law or an emergency tonight because of the chaos that is gripping the country. And we have to remember that not only has she died, several of her party stalwarts have died with her, and there is going to be a funeral followed by 40 days of mourning. So I don't think the military is going to take the risk of leaving the country, if you like, without a much tougher kind of regime while all this takes place and all this grief is expressed. So I think in the long term, it's very difficult to say what is going to happen. If there is a military regime under Musharraf, General Pervez Musharraf, I really don't think people are going to accept that. We could see down the road, perhaps, another military coup and the ousting of President Musharraf. I don't think people are going to accept a second martial law emergency under Musharraf. We should remember that Musharraf carried out an emergency on November 3rd, after which he sacked the senior judges, he curbed the media, he threw something like 10,000 people into jail. Now, he's just lifted that emergency a week earlier so that these general elections could be held on January the 8th. And despite the lifting of the emergency, there are still curbs on the judiciary, curbs on the media, but the political parties were going along with the elections.
This assassination is a terrible thing for Pakistan. What are some of the other ways it's likely to reverberate in the country and be really, you know, bad for the country?
Well, I think obviously there's going to be enormous international concern. Because Pakistan is on the front line of terrorism, the battle against Al-Qaeda. The Pakistani Taliban have been making enormous headway in the northern areas of Pakistan in recent weeks. and they will be celebrating this assassination, and they will no doubt in the next few days be taking advantage of it by launching more offensives against the army. There is enormous concern in the last few weeks also about Pakistan's nuclear weapons and the control of it and who is in control of them. There's enormous concern about political stability, given the fact that we were heading towards this election, which was supposed to restore some kind of democracy. All these questions will now be raised afresh and anew with, I think, much greater trepidation than there was before.
What do you expect you'll be doing tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow, obviously, people will be there. Will be the funeral. Benazir's husband is arriving from his exile in Dubai. We don't know if the children are coming with him. Her funeral is going to be obviously a very, very emotional event. She will be taken, no doubt, to her home village near Larkana, where her father and her grandfather are buried. And the population in that area are absolutely very, very close to the family, and there's going to be very, very strong emotional scenes there, no doubt.
Will journalists be able to report openly on what happened to Benazir Bhutto and what is happening in response to that? Or is there still a lot of censorship now?
There have been very severe media restrictions even now. For example, the army has banned all live broadcasts. Now, what has happened tonight with this assassination, actually all the local TV channels are actually broadcasting live, both from the rally where she was assassinated and they're broadcasting from the hospital where she was taken for an operation. Now, we don't know quite what's going to happen tomorrow. I mean, will there be live broadcasting of her funeral, for example? Will the government allow that to happen? Or will there be very severe, even severer restrictions placed overnight?
Thank you so much for talking with us. I know you're really busy right now. We'll let you go. Thank you, Ahmed Rashid.
Thank you very much indeed.
Journalist Ahmed Rashid spoke to us from his home in Lahore, Pakistan. This week, we're featuring a holiday series retrospective of some of our favorite interviews with actors and musicians from 2007. Today, we have an interview with Mark Ruffalo. He's starred or co-starred in such films as My Life Without Me, We Don't Live Here Anymore, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Collateral, Zodiac, and Reservation Road. He was discovered by critics and audiences in the 2000 film You Can Count on Me, in which he played Laura Linney's troubled brother. We'll start with that film. This was written by Kenneth Lonergan, who was a playwright and screenwriter, and you had worked with him before the movie. And
that's right.
You star with Laura Linney. You play two siblings who, as children, were orphaned when their parents were in a car accident. And you develop in very different waves. She becomes this kind of stable, single mother, you know, raising her child in as good a home as she can manage on her, you know, job in the local bank. Whereas you're really like troubled, you're lost, you're drifting, you're broke, and you're needy. And you come to see your sister for the first time in a long time. And this is a scene where you're meeting at a restaurant after not seeing each other for a long time, and you make a confession to her.
I actually got to confess to you, Sammy, that the reason that you may not have heard from me for a while is that I've been unable to write on the account of the fact that I was in jail for a little while.
You were what?
I served a little time, I guess, down in Florida. It was for bullshit.
What?
It was for bullshit.
What did you do?
I didn't do anything. Does it occur to you that maybe I was wrong?
No.
Well, please let me tell you what happened.
What happened?
I got into a fight in a bar down in Florida, which I was not the one who instigated it at all. But then it worked up all this bullshit against me, and they threw me in the pen for 3 months. And I didn't write you because I didn't want you to get all upset about it. I just figured that you would figure I was on the road for a little while. It was stupid. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make you worry. You know, but you want to know what? I can't run around doing stuff or not doing stuff because it's going to make you worry. Because then I come back here, I tell you about my traumas, and I get this wounded little I've let you down bullshit. over and over again. It just cramps me. I just want to get out from under it. Yeah, I'm back in this f***ing hole explaining myself to you again.
Please stop cursing at me.
I realize that I'm in no position to basically say anything ever, but it's not like I'm down there in some redneck bar in Florida. I'm having an argument with some stripper's boyfriend, and I suddenly say to myself, hey, this would be a great time to really stick it to Sammy and get myself locked up for a few months.
Hey, you don't write me for 6 months. I don't know where you are. I don't know if you're alive or dead, and then suddenly you show up out of nowhere. You tell me you were in jail.
I'm sorry, Sammy. I'm really sorry.
That's Mark Ruffalo and Laura Linney in a scene from You Can Count on Me. That's a really great scene. And that's also really early in your film career, right?
Yeah.
You just kind of captured a certain, like, you know, like defensive, lost, depressed kind of speech in that.
It's almost like it's an iconoclastic modern brokenness.
Modern brokenness, exactly. Can you talk about, like, getting to that place, doing that scene?
You know, it was introduced to me months, a year before, as a one-act play that Kenny gave to me. I had no idea it was part of a movie. And we did it for a little one-act play festival. And I was so turned on by the material. It spoke to my youth, people I grew up with, a certain ennui and lost, these very clever, smart, sort of gifted kids who just lost belief. And I saw them all around me. And it was sad because they were in many ways stellar and also but somehow lost their heart along the way, and they were different than the kids who were straight A students and the like, the really well behaved kids, like the perfect kids who were like the models at that time, and these kids were much more. Much more interesting, much more original, much more alive in so many ways, but had somehow lost faith somewhere along the way, and that was a big part of my generation from where I came from, you know, and they were the punk rockers and the artsy people and so on and so forth.
Did you feel like you were in that category yourself?
I was sort of on the edge of it. I didn't have the sort of courage to rebel as loudly and deeply as they did. But I was in it enough to witness it. And all of those you knows, you like, I mean, it's just, you know, all of that was written exactly as spoken exactly as Kenny Lonergan wrote it. He was a stickler for it, and he was able to capture a whole sort of patois of a certain aspect of my generation. Mm-hmm. And as I've traveled around all my travels, people are like, "That was my brother. That's me and my brother. That's the way my it seems like it's very American in its nature."
My guest is actor Mark Ruffalo. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Mark Ruffalo. His films include You Can Count on Me, In the Cut, We Don't Live Here Anymore, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Collateral, Zodiac, and Reservation Road. Why don't we hear a scene from In the Cut? And, you know, there's this kind of like sexual mutilation murders taking place, and you're investigating them, and one of the body parts is found in front of a a beautiful college professor's home, and in investigating her, you also become very flirtatious with her and, mm-hmm. and involved with her. Let's hear a scene, and she's played by Meg Ryan.
You don't remember anything, didn't see anything, didn't hear anything. No cries in the night.
No, I don't remember seeing or hearing anything unusual. And I sleep with the windows open.
Mm-hmm. You do that a lot?
Can you tell me how it happened?
Her throat was cut, and then she was disarticulated. Here's my card. My number's there. If you remember anything, give me a call, all right? Do I know you from someplace?
I don't know.
That's Mark Ruffalo and Meg Ryan in a scene from In the Cut. So what impact did this film have on you after Hours?
Oh, that was a really interesting time.
Well, let's explain a little bit, if you don't mind my mentioning it. This was a period, I believe this is the period, you had a benign brain tumor.
That's correct.
And had surgery for that and had an extended period of recovery. And I think this was the movie you made first afterwards.
Yes, there was a movie called My Life Without Me with Sarah Pauly that I did just before this.
Mm-hmm, okay.
I had a sort of co-starring part in that, but it was really her film. And then this was my next kind of big jump back into acting after, many months of, these kind of side effects and complications from the surgery. And I was very nervous. They go and they tinker around in your head, and it leaves you slightly disoriented. And any illness, I think I could speak for a lot of people, it's when you recover from something like that, it leaves you a little. It sort of does a number on your confidence, and you see your sort of your mortality. And so I had fear that maybe I had lost my ability to act. After a brain surgery, you're kind of you're confused. It takes a long time. There's some cognitive dysfunctions and all that sort of thing. And I was very nervous, but also very desperate, because you fall out of the Hollywood scene, and I really felt like I'd fallen between the cracks. And I was having a hard time getting work and even getting people to meet with me. And, by providence, I got a call from Jane Campion that at the time was casting In the Cut. And, I had put on 40 pounds from steroids that I was given to recover. And I went in and I met Jane Campion and talked about the script. And it ended up terrifying me, but I also felt very passionate about what I could do with it. And I was also very raw and desperate and kind of vulnerable. And she reacted to that. And then she basically, after 3 hours of discussing the part and arguing about the part in certain places, she asked me to do it.
One of the things I imagine must have been strange doing the part after this period of recovery is, I mean, when you're not feeling well, you don't really want to be seen. You feel vulnerable, you feel kind of broken, and you feel kind of, cut off from the rest of the world in some ways.
Yes.
And to go from that into like being on a large screen, blown up, supersized, with people paying attention to your every gesture, every eye blink, it's such a completely different frame of mind. It must be so difficult to go from the vulnerable recovery one to the I am on screen version. Yeah.
Yes, thrust right into the world stage kind of. Yeah, and in a way, a lot of that actually worked for the part.
How?
I mean, he's not exactly, he isn't a vulnerable guy, but there was something that was edgy and dangerous about me at that time. And very frightened. And a lot of that sort of, I think, manifested itself in that performance, which I'm really, that risk of sounding egotistical, I'm really proud of that performance, you know?
Oh, you should be. It's a very good performance.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And so it meant so much to me on so many different levels that succeeded. It was sort of my chance to come back. It was a chance to break away from this my You Can Count on Me role, Terry Prescott, which kind of broke my career.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, broke me out. It gave me a chance to prove myself as a man and to prove myself as a character actor, which is the tradition that I come from. It had an enormous amount of immediacy and almost a desperation about it that I think really sort of makes that piece special.
Mark Ruffalo recorded in October. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now exhibiting sculptures by Martin Puryear. More at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
How big was Maria Callas's career? There's a new 70 CD set of the legendary opera singer's studio recordings and a DVD compilation of her work. Lord Schwartz has a review. And we continue our conversation with Mark Ruffalo. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor Mark Ruffalo. His movies include You Can Count on Me, In the Cut, We Don't Live Here Anymore, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Collateral, Zodiac, and Reservation Road. You know, your career actually got off to a pretty slow start, right? You were a bartender for 9 years while you were trying to act. So what was one of the highlights of your bartending years? What was one of the most difficult incidents you had to handle?
I had a friend of mine start a fight in the bar, and it was mostly all the highlights were the bar fights. Really, those were sort of the man making moments of a pacifist, peace lover, peacenik like myself. you know, I went into bartending very timid and very afraid, and I walked out of it a little bit more of a man.
What's a fight? Did you have to actually break up fights yourself?
I had to. Well, I mean, one guy like really started to get physical with somebody, and I don't know why I did this, but I just, he was much bigger than me, and I really knew the. I basically grabbed his windpipe and dragged him out of the bar. And, you know, he was threatening to kill me and all these things. And it was really out of control. And it was terrifying to me. But I was, you know, it was just one of those moments where something else kicks in that's survival oriented. But it was horrible as well, and I didn't like that I did that, and I sort of, you know, and I didn't hurt him ultimately, but it did stop him immediately, and it stopped this whole what was turning into an incredibly ugly bar fight.
Did the fact that you could do that give you confidence that you could handle roles as, for instance, cops?
It opened up this thing that I could handle myself in that situation. I got into a fight when I was a little kid, and it must have only lasted a couple minutes, but it felt like an eternity, and I hated every second of it, and I was very terrified of confrontation from that moment on, and then here I am. As a young actor struggling and closed down to fearful of confrontation, which all modern drama is based on.
Right.
And I was able to sort of break through it, you know, and actually I felt like, okay, you know what, I have that in me. I mean, I can do that. I can play those parts. I can access that, you know.
So that bartender thing was a good experience for you in the long run.
Well, I mean, it was, you know, the whole bartending thing was the last place. You know, I'm reading, I'm reading Rilke, and you know, and Pablo Neruda's love poems, and then going to this really rough and tumble bar every night. And doing a play and passing out my little playbills and with all these guys, some of them were heroin addicts, some of them were just like never read a book in their lives, you know, and here I was straddling these two worlds, and it was very tough. I mean, a guy got killed outside our door one night, a gangster, and there was some retribution. We were asked to wear bulletproof vests and...
Gee.
You know, it couldn't have been in many ways a more of like a crash course in just the macho manly world of testosterone.
I think you started a theater company, the Orpheus Theater, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Me and a group of young actors that I went to acting school with all got together, and we were at the Stella Adler Conservatory, and they had the school stage sitting empty every night. And so I went to the administrator and I said, listen, I want to start a theater company. We should be able to work out, these tools that we've been given. And so we were given Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night on the stage. And that was kind of the beginning of what would be my Los Angeles theater career.
So what was the focus of the kind of theater you wanted to do?
We were doing we were doing some Chekhov. We did some, we did Long Day's Journey Into Night. We did some Tennessee Williams. They were kind of American modern classics, some of them. And then we'd try and dabble with some Shakespeare and, but a lot of it was the stuff that Stella was sort of teaching at the time, which was a lot of the American classics or world classics, modern classics.
It must be great to start your own theater company, because that way you can... It's a small group, and you give yourself parts. You decide what you want to do, and you give yourself parts. You're not dependent on somebody else to confer acting on you.
Exactly. And I could do a $5,000 production, a $2,000 production of Misalliance, or I could do a $2,000 production of Waiting for Godot, or no one came.
But you got the experience.
Yes, but I got to play some of the greatest parts for a young actor in you know, the history of world theater. So that was, you know, I worked it out on a stage in front of a very, 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 very small group of people.
My guest is Mark Ruffalo. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Mark Ruffalo. His films include You Can Count on Me, In the Cut, We Don't Live Here Anymore, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Collateral, Zodiac, and Reservation Road. You know, a little earlier when we were talking, you know, we were talking about You Can Count on Me and In the Cut as being the movies that you made after emerging from an extended period of recovery after having surgery for a benign brain tumor. Would you mind if I just asked you a couple of questions about that period?
No, shoot.
What were some of the things you had to regain when the surgery was over?
Well, certainly balance was immediate. I lost my hearing in my left ear, and so my balance was completely shot. You know, so I was falling. It was actually comical. I was just falling down all the time for the first couple of months. Walk a few steps, fall down. And then, you know, every hour you're under anesthesia, they say it's a month of recovery. So that's 10 months right there. And they say you have cognitive dysfunctions, which, you know, can be simple things like finding your way home from one side of Washington Square to the other, which I got lost doing one night.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, kind of abstract sort of processes, these kind of abstract creative ideas seem to get a little muddled as well. So there was a time of kind of getting myself back, you know, getting your sense of self, sense of independence, sense of, you know, I had to completely basically give my life over to my wife at the time.
What about things like facial expressions that are so important when you're acting?
Well, I had, during the course I had of recovery, my face miraculously became paralyzed on the left side of my face.
Hmm.
And no one seemed to really know exactly why that was happening. They pretended like they did for a little while, and then slowly but surely I caught on to the fact that they had no more of an idea than I did. And they tried a bunch of different things, and it didn't seem to be coming back. And, you know, there was some speculation that it wasn't going to come back at all, or it was only going to come back 20-30%. And as an actor, just starting my career, that was pretty devastating news with a newborn and recently married and you know, everything ahead of me in so many ways. And so a big part of the recovery was praying, hoping, going to healers, doing all kinds of therapies.
Did the tumor and the period of recovery force you to change certain patterns of behavior or ways of acting that you wouldn't have otherwise given up, but in the long run, like, you're happy you were forced to change?
Yeah, I mean, I was someone who's always prone to deep, deep depressions. And those seem to come to an end. I mean, the length of them certainly did. That's something that I'm very grateful for. Also...
But you don't get them anymore?
I get them, man. Believe me, I get them. But I don't slide down the well the way I used to.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned to appreciate acting in a way that I didn't really understand what it meant to me at that time.
What does it mean to you different now than it did earlier?
It's kind of my way to be fully realized as a human being. I feel like, you know, it's my relationship to the world that's just gonna you know, make my life sort of as full as it could possibly be.
Were you afraid after you recovered that other, like, casting directors wouldn't believe that you were fully recovered and they'd be afraid to hire you?
I heard someone was like, we heard you had AIDS. We heard you were in rehab. We heard you're an alcoholic. I mean, it just went on and on and on. And yeah, I mean, you're damaged goods. I even today, I don't like to talk about it, but because it's you, Terry, I will.
I appreciate that.
Because I know you'll handle it well. There's a perception in our culture where if you're ill, you're damaged. You go to the damaged goods box.
Mm-hmm.
With the misfit toys, and that was frightening to me. And I also people sensationalize these things into making it, oh, it's the actor with the brain tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not the actor with the brain tumor. I'm much more than that, and any person who's been ill is much more than simply their illness. So, it took a long time it didn't take as long as I thought it was going to, but it took a long time to sort of get back into the groove that I was in before the brain tumor.
There's some roles that you've had in the past few years that are more kind of like the existential guy, the guy who, you know, I'd say this maybe even about like Zodiac, you know, the detective that you play. Mm-hmm. He's kind of obsessed in everything, but there's a distance from emotion, a fatalistic quality, accepting that life is dark and difficult, and that that's just the way it is.
Well, someone who's much brighter than me, and I'm going to rip off his quote, the joyful participation in the sorrows of the living. That's Joseph Campbell. And, I don't know why I see that. I have a lot of empathy for the human race.
Mm-hmm.
And it's march through time. And it's connection to suffering and hardship and difficulties, as well as joy and, you know, the beautiful things in life. And there's something very poetic to me about that. And so maybe I'm attracted to that when I see it. You know, it's something that I'm always slightly aware of. You know, there's just the epoch nature of our existence. You know, that spans many, 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 many decades, centuries, where the human experience is universal, universally sort of riddled with difficulty and exaltation and so part of me poetically sees that, so maybe that's I admire it and revel in it in a way, and so maybe that's what you pick up on in the, mm-hmm. in some of the work maybe.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's just a completely different question.
Okay.
I know your mother is or was a hairdresser, and you have a couple of siblings who became hairdressers.
Yeah.
So
when
you're getting like your hair and makeup done for a role, can you converse with the person doing it on a real like technical level because you grew up with it?
They hate me because I'm like, okay, you know what? Get the thinning shears out. I'd go with the quarter inch thinning shears here, right up in here. Just to look. Actually, can I just give them to me? I'll do it. And I know they hate me, and you know, it would be like me giving people line readings. I think. A director giving an actor a line reading. I grew up in it. I watched it. I've been around it. I've had many, 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 many haircuts. So it's kind of funny. I know when I work on a movie, I end up at some point cutting my own hair to everyone's horror. You know?
What movies have you done your own hair for?
I cut my hair for In the Cut.
Uh huh.
I cut my hair for Eternals. The more
you had a mustache on In the Cut too.
Yeah, that's right.
Was that your idea? Was it?
Yeah, well, I wanted it, and there was a lot of fighting going back and forth between Jane and the producer. Like, nobody likes a man with a mustache, and I was like, he has to have a mustache.
Why does he have to have a mustache?
I was hiding behind it, you know. Uh-huh. It was my disguise, I think, to get it to be able to inhabit that guy without being self-conscious, I think. Maybe.
So you think you needed it more than he needed it?
Probably, yeah. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which is a pretty wild hairdo. I cut that too. I mean, and eventually someone else comes and cleans up the mess I make, but those are some.
Well, Mark Ruffalo, it's really been great to talk with you. I really like your acting.
Too.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Terry. It's a real pleasure and honor to talk to you.
Mark Ruffalo, recorded in October 2007. Tomorrow, we'll continue our Holiday Week series featuring some of our favorite interviews from 2007 with actors, filmmakers, and musicians. We'll hear from Nancy Cartwright, who does the voice of Bart Simpson, and Al Jean, an executive producer of The Simpsons TV show and a writer and producer of The Simpsons movie. Coming up next, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a 70-CD box set. Who merits such a massive compilation? Maria Callas. This is Fresh Air. Even 30 years after the death of soprano Maria Callas at the age of 53, not only have her recordings remained in print, but new material has continued to surface. EMI is commemorating this 30th anniversary by issuing and reissuing what classical music Lloyd Schwartz considers some significant early recordings and videos. Here's Lloyd's review.
No single performance can ever quite capture a great artist's full range. But Maria Callas's range was so great that it takes a 70-disc collection to tell the story. Maria Callas, The Complete Studio Recordings, is a new digitally remastered set at a bargain price of every complete opera Callas ever recorded, four of them twice at opposite ends of her career, plus all her recital CDs, arranged in the order she made them, which is especially revealing given the way her voice, like her physical appearance, kept changing. You can hear her artistry deepening as her vocal limitations increased. The very best recording I know of Aida's complex Ritorna Vincitor is one Callas made quite late in her career, and by accident. During a break in a difficult recording session, someone played a tape of another soprano singing this aria. "This is not Verdi or Aida," she exclaimed. Come on, Nicola, she said to the conductor. Let's sing it. I can't think of a more powerful depiction of a character torn apart by inner conflict.
Ritorna vincitore, e dal mio labbro uscì l'empia parola. Vincitore del padre mio, di lui che pugno d'armi per me, per ridonarmi una patria, una reggia, e il nome illustre che qui c'è d'armi forza. Vincitore di miei fratelli, un Dio lo vinco, vinto del sangue amore, triunfur del caso delle egizie corti, e dietro il carro un re mio padre di catena vinto.
Callas demonstrated a profound understanding of human suffering, whether depicting innocent victims or characters who cause their own grief. But these recordings also prove her to be a master of comic timing and mercurial mood swings. In some of her best roles, Carmen is a memorable example. She can be simultaneously tragic and comic. Callas started to record in 1949, when she was a hefty 25-year-old, and her big, blossoming voice could handle just about anything. She astounded the opera world by singing exquisite coloratura and heroic Wagner within the same week. But what made Callas legendary was her unique ability to inhabit a role, to become the character she was singing. Which is why hearing all her recordings is so amazing. No singing voice ever had a more astonishing variety of color and inflection. And on a new DVD compilation, The Eternal Callas, you can actually watch her uncanny ability to change character. As Carmen, she tilts her head back, juts out her jaw, lets an ironic, knowing smile flicker across her lips, and defies you to resist her. Yet in the same concert, same hairdo, same evening gown, her face, her look, is completely different. Contrite, yet still proud as Verdi's Princess Eboli, who curses the fatal gift of her own beauty.
O don crudel, che in suo furore mi fece il cielo, tu che ci fui, si vane altere, ti maledico, ti maledico.
Thank you.
This DVD mostly recycles material previously available. But there's a special bonus, the first commercial release of a rediscovered 1957 New Year's Eve telecast from Rome of Callas singing Casta Diva, the Druid priestess Norma's fervent invocation to the moon. You can hear the trance-like devotion in her voice and see every nuance of that devotion on Callas's radiant face. We're lucky recordings and videos document her career so thoroughly. 30 years after her too early death, these ambitious new releases are a great reminder of how much she had to give.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He reviewed EMI's Maria Callas, The Complete Studio Recordings, and the DVD, The Eternal Callas. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think, by food psychologist Brian Wansink. More at mindlesseating.org. From Kaufman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kaufman.org. And from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Juno, starring Ellen Page, Michael Cera, Jennifer Garner, and Jason Bateman. Now playing in select theaters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Simpsons movie is now out on DVD. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from Nancy Cartwright, who does the voice of Bart Simpson, and Al Jean, an executive producer of the TV series and a producer and writer of the film. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.